Welcome to a series of netcasts brought to you by Yale University. George Taylor and John Booty, co-founders of Taylor and Booty Organ Builders, discuss the process of building the new Opus 55 organ in Marquand Chapel. Joining Mr. Taylor and Mr. Booty is Martin Jean, director of the Institute of Sacred Music.
This is Kirsten Kartoski for Yale University. In celebrating the installation of the Taylor and Booty Opus 55 pipe organ, I'm here with George Taylor and John Booty of Taylor and Booty Organ Builders, and Martin Jean, the director of the Institute of Sacred Music. The installation in the Marquand Chapel began on June 6th and continued for a number of weeks. However, this weekend it culminates a decade of work to bring this organ into existence. I have to imagine that this is a great feeling for all of you, to just watch this fruition come into being. How do you feel about it?
For me, it's the culmination of 10 years of dreaming. I came here to Yale in 1997, and in fact, already at that time, my colleagues in the ISM and my colleagues in Yale Divinity School were planning a renovation of the Sterling Divinity Quadrangle. And as part of that renovation, they were considering a new organ for an organ studio. I came and said, well, why don't we put the organ in the chapel and make it slightly bigger so it can be used for worship. So 10 years later, finally, here we are today.
So how did Yale University come to choose Taylor and Booty to create this organ?
So the concept of the organ was developed most recently, about 4 years ago. That's when we signed the contract, I think, 4 or 5 years ago.
Yes,
before I became
5 years ago,
my director, in fact, the credit goes to my predecessor, Margot Fasser, who was director until December of 2004. Margot's still on the faculty, but we really hold her in such great esteem and with such gratitude for her pioneering in getting the project approved. And in fact, this is part of a much larger project which renovated Marquand Chapel and provided an ideal acoustical environment for, thanks to Dana Kierkegaard, our acoustician, and the whole array of things that were added to Marquand to give Marquand Chapel kind of a facelift during the project. We engaged in a search. We had an idea of the kind of organ we wanted to build. We were looking for an instrument that would not duplicate the other sort of three major performing instruments that we have here, which include the organ at Woolsey Hall, our famous Skinner Newberry organ, the organ in Battelle Chapel, and the organ in Dwight Chapel. So those three organs all sort of do kind of specific things, and they do them very, very well. We wanted something that would complement that so that we had another sort of avenue to a whole other body of repertoire. So we thought at the time the most logical style to look at was a style that of organ that you see in North Europe, in the Netherlands and North Germany. Once we've narrowed that choice down, it was fairly easy to look at a short list of builders who were expert in that. We considered builders in Europe, several builders in the United States, and it didn't take us long at all to realize that the very best company to do this work would be Taylor and Booty Organ Builders.
Excellent. So I understand that the new instrument is tuned to a mean tone temperament. Did this play in your decision, and what is a mean tone temperament, if anybody can explain that?
Well, I'd have to ask Martin, first of all, if he dreamed of having a mean tone instrument at the beginning, and then we'll talk about what this was. Did you, in fact, want a particular an organ with a particular character in the tuning?
Temperament is an important expressive device when it comes to musical instruments. The organs that we have currently are all in equal temperament. In fact, almost virtually all the organs in the whole region of New Haven are all in equal temperament, which simply means that all keys, all 24 major and minor keys, are sort of equally accessible and sound equal. simply by the way, by virtue of the fact that the instrument is tuned in this way. Historic instruments, the ones that we were looking at as models, use temperaments that favor other certain keys over others. So in a sense, you have good keys and bad keys. And the good keys sound more in tune and more colorful and more pure. So there were several choices open to us. We thought that the most striking and the most expressive, the most powerful would be using mean tone tuning.
Yes. And mean tone tuning is based on the concept of having a perfect third in the chord. And for that, in order to generate the perfect third, the fifths have to be a bit narrower than they are in equal temperament, a little bit. If you were playing a C-E-G chord, then the third is flatter than we are accustomed to in equal temperament, but it's pure. It's in pure tune, so there are no beats between C and E. And the G, the fifth, is also lower than it is accustomed, and it has a lovely undulating beat to it. And so when you play this chord, and this is true of any of the chords which work in the mean tone tuning, you have this lovely relationship of the pure third and the gently undulating fifth. And it's quite mesmerizing and intoxicating and addictive, actually, particularly to organ builders. We would love to be able to tune this way all the time.
Wow.
We say that these chords that are tuned in this way sound sweeter than they do in equal temperament.
Really?
Yeah. And what it also means is that all 12 half steps of the chromatic scale are now tuned unequally.
Oh,
so
wow.
if you're playing a passage that is chromatic, mm-hmm. There's much more sparkle and color in the sort of harmonic progressions than you'd get in equal temperament. It's very powerful and pungent and at moments.
And you have to realize that this mean tone tuning was a very normal kind of tuning. In fact, the old organ contracts up until, about 1750, they never ever specified any kind of tuning system because everybody tuned in this mean tone tuning. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until the time of when J.S. Bach was fairly late in his career when the theoreticians were starting to advocate other systems of tuning, which opened up the more remote keys to being utilized in the composition. And so the mean tone tuning was a very, very normal thing, and it was very important to the church music, not only for the organ literature, but also for the singing of the hymns and the very power of the instrument coupled with the congregation. And when they first started advocating giving up mean tone tuning, the church musicians wrote these impassioned pleas saying, how will we ever get the congregations to sing the music if we're not singing in this old tuning system? So it was a very, very, very important thing for the tuning, and to have an organ here at Yale that exposes not only the organ literature to this wonderful system of tuning, but also coupled with the Yale Divinity School and using the organ in a worship setting, and we experience that today of powerful hymn singing, very enthusiastic and wonderful coupling of the organ with the words and the music. It's a very, very, very powerful experience.
Wow, that is amazing. I cannot wait to hear this organ.
Let me just add one thing, if I could, that might be useful. So in English, the term mean tone sort of gets a bum rap. Because people,
right.
People who hear the word, they say, oh, it's a tuning
angry.
That sounds mean. And of course, in other languages, like in German, it's mitteltönig, middle tone, mm-hmm. or moyen ton in French. The remarkable thing about this kind of tuning is it's actually the kind of tuning that the ear wants to tune to naturally. So if a choir is singing a cappella, they're actually sort of singing the thirds and fifths in tune. We noticed this in a rehearsal Wednesday night. Our Schola Cantorum, Simon Carrington conducting, will sing a polychoral motet with the organ Saturday night. And they're singing, using the organ as the accompaniment instrument for this motet, was completely natural. They did it with absolutely no effort, because it's how they want to sing anyway. They want to sing in tune in this way.
Speaking a little bit more about how the organ was created, I understand that you all created in Stanton, Virginia. Can you talk a little bit more about the building process and how you got it all from Virginia all the way up here to New Haven? I mean, that seems like an amazing feat in and of itself.
Talk about the research part of it first.
Well, we became particularly interested in studying the models of organs that were built this way. Mm-hmm. And we've done this over the years with other instruments that we've built. This is not the first instrument that we've built in this style. It's the first organ we've tuned this way. We spoke with Martin here about his favorite organs in Europe that he enjoyed, and ended up looking at a very particular instrument in a small village near Cuxhaven in Germany, a little place called Ludingvoort, a very old church which has an organ built in the 17th century by Antonius Wilde. And this organ has survived to this day and has been restored beautifully in the 1980s by Jürgen Arendt in Germany. And we took a particular liking to that organ, and Martin needed to have a drawing at the beginning of the project so he could sell the university on the idea that this might look good, at least.
Right.
And people usually want to have an idea of what they trust their eyes better than their ears.
Yeah.
And so we always have to make a drawing. And the easiest way to make a drawing for a project that you don't yet have in under contract is to look at something that you like and sketch it. And so we turned to the Ludingvoort organ case, which happened to fit beautifully into the space, mm-hmm. With certain modifications, and I made a drawing of that for Martin. And so we found ourselves even more closely wed to that particular instrument. And as the project has developed, we have spent a great deal of time researching in that organ and other organs similar to it. And this constituted our research, traveling in Europe, listening to the organs, looking at the measurements and scales, and finding out as much as we could, which we have incorporated into the organ as best we could.
Wow.
And the scales are actually measuring, taking the historic pipes and examining them very carefully and measuring the diameters of the pipes, the height of the mouth of the pipe, the size of the wind way where the wind blows across the mouth of the pipe, the thickness of the metal, the alloy of the metal, and generally how the organ is laid out, what the organization of the pipes and the wind chest is, and then further on, measuring the length of the keys, where the mechanical action attaches to the key, how big the springs are, how big the wind chests are, how big the wind channels are. You can really quantify almost every measurement in these historic organs. So we spent a number of days measuring and examining, especially the organ in Ludingvoort, very, very carefully. And we haven't made a copy of the Ludingvoort organ, but we've done, as we kept saying, that we wanted the organ to look, feel, smell, and taste like the original.
Wow.
So it's a strong evocation of this historic instrument. You can never, ever, you know, people want to make Stradivarius violins. We
yeah.
can't make it exactly. But we, in our experience, and this is one reason why Martin Jean and Yale University chose us to do this work. George Taylor was trained in Hamburg, Germany as an organ builder, so he was steeped in this Germanic tradition of organ building, and I was also trained by a German who was trained in Germany and came to the United States. So this is our clothing. We're used to wearing these hats of building this type of instrument. So it was fairly easy for us to take our 40-some-odd years of experience and take it one big step further. And for us, it was a tremendous pleasure of working with Martin and the Institute of Sacred Music and Yale University to bring this type of instrument to a fuller blooming than has ever been done in this country.
Wow, that's great. And you guys also make organs for other places around the country. Is that right? Or...
Well, this is our number 55 instrument. So we've had a long life of mostly building organs for churches in Normal, but we have a fair number of instruments both here and in Japan that were built for universities. So we have spent a long time thinking about the literature and this style of building and developing our craft and technique. Our workshop in Stanton, Virginia is a kind of a multifaceted craft workshop where we can melt the lead and tin metal for the pipes. We pour the sheets, we hammer the metal, we scrape it, we form the pipes, some over 2,000 pipes for this organ we form by hand. We solder the pipes up, we do the wood carving, we make the keys, we make the bellows. All the parts of the organ are made pretty much under one roof, one place. And about 90% of the work is old-fashioned handwork. We're not buying something that's made in some foreign country that comes in a container and we're unwrapping it. It's real old-fashioned craft work, and that's a very unusual thing. And pipe organs are one of the few products that are made in this way today in a virtually unchanged technology. If Johann Sebastian Bach came to visit us in Stanton, Virginia, and walked into our workshop, it would look very, very familiar to him.
Wow.
The techniques and the way we're doing our work. So it's been a very satisfying experience, and this was a great chance for us to take our craftsmanship and our work one big step further than we've ever been able to do it before. I think Martin should talk about the sub-semitones and the extra keys in the keyboard, because I think that's one of the more interesting things about it from a player's standpoint.
So there's certain challenges for the performer when she or he come to this organ, not the least of which is that the dimensions of the keys are slightly wider. There are fewer octaves on the keyboard than you have on modern organs, and the pedal board is laid out in a slightly different way. Probably the most striking difference between these keyboards and sort of more modern organ keyboards is that the octave is actually divided into either 14 notes on the top two keyboards or 15 notes on the bottom keyboard. So what that implies is that, or what that allows you to do is have an E flat that is tuned pure to a G. That's a major third apart. Mm-hmm. But normally, E flat is enharmonic, or it's the same note as a D sharp on modern keyboards. But in this keyboard, a D sharp is a different note. Because if you tune a D sharp to a B, again, a major third apart, it's a different pitch than E flat.
Okay.
Because the major thirds create these differences in the chromatic scale. So the way this looks physically is the black key, so to say, the accidental note E flat, is divided into two parts, a front part and a back part. And the back part is raised slightly higher than the front part is. Mm-hmm. And the front part is the E flat, and the back part is the D sharp.
Wow!
So this happens with D sharp and E flat. It happens with G sharp and A flat. On the bottom keyboard, it also happens with B flat and A sharp.
So how does that feel when you're whizzing up and down the keyboard and having to select the correct sub-semitone?
It takes a bit of adjustment, but you know, it's not that big a deal. The keyboards are so exquisitely made and so beautifully shaped and feel so good. The wood that they're made of and the proportions, the way they're carved, the way they're beveled, is so natural feeling, to me at least, that I don't find it difficult.
And this having of the sub-semitones, as we call them, is is a wonderful pedagogical tool, also for the organ builders. When we sit down and are testing the organ or playing, and one is improvising, mm-hmm. as you would on an equal tempered organ, for example.
Right.
And you have never thought before of the difference between E-flat and D-sharp.
Right.
And if
they're very different notes.
They're very different. They're nearly a quarter of a tone apart in pitch.
Wow. That's, I've never heard that before.
And so if you were to play a B major chord and strike the E-flat, you will know immediately, and you learn really quickly. It's like sticking your finger into a socket. Or something. Suddenly you realize that this is not right, and it makes you think. And you have to think about the difference between D-sharp and E-flat.
Wow.
This is not unusual in world music. I mean, the octave is divided into all different kinds of parts in different national styles. Asian music has a very different types of Asian music. There are many, many, of course, have different kinds of scales, and
right.
they're all tuned differently.
This was not only a musical challenge of building this temperament and the sub-semitones, but it was a technological challenge for the organ builders, because although when you look at the keyboards, you come to the organ and look at the keyboards, and they look tiny because the span of the octaves is not very big. It's a rather compact. There are four octaves, and the keyboards look very compact. But for us, technically, it's a very dense array of keys because you have all these extra keys inserted into the normal keyboard span. So we had to think very carefully, engineering-wise, how to cut the key levers. And we ended up going back to the Ludingvoort organ and realized that the keys were made out of oak wood. And because some of the keys get very, very narrow, there's not a lot of strength in the key, so the only wood you can use is oak. So we had to specially cut some very fine oak wood for making these keys. We had to dry the wood for long term to make sure the wood was going to behave well. We cut out hundreds of these levers, the key levers, and we discarded many of them that weren't going to perform well. And then we assembled the keyboard and checked to make sure that it was going to perform well. So it was a big involved process for us. And it was a very good exercise for us to go back again to the historic model, even for the very keys themselves. And the surprising thing is that when you come and play the organ, it gives a feel, a touch to the organist that is unlike anything we've done. And it takes, when you sit down at the organ here, you're suddenly in Ludingvoort.
Wow.
You're ready to go out after you play and look for a good German beer.
Where does this organ fit into the mission of the Yale Institute of Sacred Music?
So the mission of the ISM is to the study and practice of sacred music, worship, and the arts. We were founded here at Yale in 1973 as a kind of a grandsister institution to the Union School of Sacred Music in New York City, which closed its doors in 72. Our faculty and students are studying and teaching church music, liturgical studies, religion and the arts. Some of them are particularly interested in the performance of sacred music, so they're going on to be the next Bach evangelist, or they'll be choral conductors and so on and so forth. This organ has many purposes, at least two of which are certainly to teach our organ majors something very specific about a certain repertoire that's important in the history of sacred music, and that is the North European Protestant sacred music tradition, which is based on hymns that we still sing today. There's a long, long, long list of organ repertoire based on these hymns, and then there's a whole raft of music that's freely composed. That's kind of meant to go in liturgical services. So, and this is the one of the musical traditions that led to Bach and the place of Bach in music history. But secondly, and equally as important, the organ does not sit in a generic concert hall. but rather we intentionally asked permission to our divinity colleagues to put it in Marquand Chapel because we wanted to offer it as a tool for the services that happen daily in Marquand Chapel, Monday through Friday. So the organ is being used already for hymn singing, for prelude posts, to accompany choirs, to accompany instruments, singers. It's used in all kinds of ways. And the wonderful thing about it is it's not an organ that's only for old music. For example, we've commissioned Matthew Suter, who teaches here in the drama school, to write a brand new piece, hot off the press as of 1 month ago, just for this organ. It will be played on many organs, of course, but we wanted this organ to also play contemporary music. And this morning in the Eucharist, I use it to accompany an 18th century hymn tune, a 16th century hymn tune, and a Korean tune, a little folk tune that's used in Korean churches.
And a newly composed hymn.
And a newly composed hymn written for on a text of one of my colleagues, Thomas Troger. This hymn was written by one of our choral majors, Dominic DiOrio. Beautiful hymn, purpose-built for this instrument, and we sang it for the first time this morning.
It was purposely built for the organ.
Yeah.
Thrillingly built. Yeah.
It's one of the most interesting things that we wish to encourage with an organ like this is improvisation.
Really?
And the best way to make that happen, not only with this, as we say, very special tuning system, which is compelling, but it is important that the organ builder somehow make the sound of the pipes so compelling that one simply cannot stop playing and just sit there and listen to the sounds that are coming out of the organ.
Yeah.
And if we can inspire people that way, that is where music needs to go. And this is really exciting because improvisation is an art which has been somewhat forgotten, and it's coming back to life. And through this sort of project, an instrument of this sort, and the sounds that we've been able to recreate or to develop for ourselves, really, based on studying the best examples of the past, these things come together to encourage this new music, which is really fascinating.
Wow.
And the organ has a very intimate relationship with the player. And that's, the general public normally thinks of an organ as this massive thing playing in a cathedral and washed over by this huge sound, you know.
Right.
And that's a wonderful thing about organs, and that's something that's very evocative for people. But the Marquand Chapel organ is an intimate setting where the organist is enticed by this close coupling of touch of the key, and the pipes are rather close to you, so you hear this, the sound comes kind of around you, there's a division right behind you at your back, there's another division of the organ that's right up over your head behind a beautiful wood carving, some very tender stops, and then there's the great organ or the Oberwerk part of the organ, which is just above your head. And all the front pipes are sitting out here. And as you play, as you touch each key, each pipe is speaking to you as an individual. And they all have individual characters. And so you're very engaged with this, all I can call it is intimate music making. You're friends with these pipes. And for someone like Martin, I think it's a new deal. It's a new experience to have this kind of closeness to this musical aspect of the organ.
Our problem is to teach these pipes to sing. We like to think of them as a choir, and each of these 2,000 pipes has only one job to do in its life.
Yeah.
And like choristers, some of them are recalcitrant and difficult, and others are beautiful from the minute you have them speak. And so we spend several months here working through the pipes in what we call voicing, which is giving the proper timbre and volume and speech, and then tuning, which goes along with that, giving them the proper pitch.
there's something anthropomorphic about the pipe organ, in a sense that, as John and George are saying, the pipes are intimately connected to the human voice. And again, this is another reason why we're attracted to this particular style, because this kind of organ was designed to accompany the human voice, singing, that is, congregational singing. So we say that the organ has a mouth, it has ears, it has, not on this organ, but even some organs have, organ pipes have beards. It has a toe, it has feet, it has a tongue, yeah. It has pipe speech, and the technique they use to get the pipes to behave themselves is called voicing. And all of these things pull together to make this particular kind of organ and not the only ideal organ for the human voice, but certainly one of the great kinds of instruments.
One of the things we have not mentioned is the winding of the organ.
What is that?
Well, a real organ has wind.
Right.
Speaks with wind, just as a human being does. And for this, we have to have some way of raising the wind. And in the traditional organ, before electricity came along, this wind had to be raised and pumped into bellows by human power. And on this organ, we have a stack of three large bellows. Each bellows is about 3 feet by 6 feet in a box at the back of the, behind the organ. And those bellows can be filled with wind by stepping on a foot lever. Each one has its own, and you can, as we say, cock the bellows, make it take a deep breath, just as you do when you're singing, catch your breath, and then the wind from that bellows is forced into the organ and when you need it. And while that bellows is feeding the organ, you fill the other two bellows. And so you have to make certain that at least one bellows is running at any given time.
Right.
Otherwise, the organ will run out of wind. But unlike people, the organ can keep going because it does have three bellows. And with our lungs, we have to breathe with both lungs at the same time. If we could breathe with one lung and then the other, we could just keep on singing without catching our breath. The organ can do that. In case one doesn't want to have a friend back there pumping, there is an electric blower on the organ, which will fill the bellows and is very useful for practice. But the organ actually sounds best if it is foot pumped.
We'll have to use that electric blower if I can't get some of my organ students to pump the organ tonight.
The inauguration of this organ begins this weekend, but I understand there are many events throughout the academic year. Are there any in particular that you're looking forward to, or will you all be attending them? And
well, I'll be at all of them. this weekend's activities include two recitals by Harald Vogel, who's probably the most renowned interpreter of North European organ music, 17th century North European organ music. Harald was my teacher for one semester in 1999. And then on Saturday night, the organ, Harald, myself, the organ will be joined by Robert Mealy, Melissa Hughes. Melissa Hughes is one of our graduates of our voice program. Robert Mealy is a baroque violinist on the faculty here. The Schola Cantorum is singing Pifaro, early music ensemble from New York City, is coming to play. So it's the Saturday evening's performance is featuring the organ as a team player, so to say, accompanying all these various forces. And we're also featuring this commission work by Matthew Suter tonight. Then in December, I'll be playing my faculty recital there, a program of Advent and Christmas music in second week of December. Jack Young Oh from Seoul, Korea, will give a recital in January. And William Porter, former faculty and graduate of Yale, will play in the Easter season in April.
Great. That's an awesome lineup, and I'm looking forward to all those. Thanks for coming down to the studio.
Thank you.
Marquand Chapel plays host to a variety of events this year to celebrate the arrival of Opus 55. For a full list of events, please visit yale.edu/ism. This was recorded on October 5th, 2007.